Your attention, please. The lid is on. Thank you and good night.
When I was 19, that's what I believed. You could change the world overnight and you could do it through violence, or that you should do it through violence. Well, then what are you going to be left with other than violence? I think they need to understand that they have a role to play. Their role has to be constructive. If it's going to be destructive, then you're just going to become another statistic. All they're left in is a loop of violence that only ends in death.
Welcome to The Lid Is On from United Nations Radio. In this podcast, a former violent extremist who rejoiced when the first plane struck New York's World Trade Center in 2001 gives some advice to the young men who stand in his shoes today. When the second plane hit on September the 11th, Mubin Sheikh, a Canadian born and raised in the Toronto area, began to have doubts, realizing that many civilians were likely to die. A self-declared global jihadist for 6 years, he rethought his view of Islam, even going on to join the Canadian Intelligence Service. I'm Matthew Wells, and I'll be talking in depth to Mubin Sheikh about the journey he's made and finding out what he thinks the UN and governments need to do to help others take the same path as he did in the age of ISIL, Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab. The problem of countering terrorism has grown too large for any one country or region to deal with, and so the United Nations is trying to coordinate a global prevention strategy. As the world watches the latest attack on the nightly news, confidence in the power of nation states is being eroded everywhere, straining relations over complex issues like the refugee crisis and European integration post-Brexit. Sheikh was invited to UN headquarters in June to take part in a high-level panel discussion on de-radicalisation, rehabilitation and reintegration, focused on children and youth. Afterwards, we went to the studio, and he began by talking about his roots.
Well, I'm born and raised in Toronto, Canada. My parents are from India. I grew up with two competing cultures. So I would go to the public school by daytime, which was mixed classes, boys and girls, you know, diverse backgrounds, a caring, nurturing environment. And in the evening time, I would go to Quran school. And Quran school was boys and girls do not mix. It's not a diverse group. And it wasn't a very caring, nurturing environment. And so this created an identity conflict that would manifest later on in my life. Because as I was going through public school, then to high school, you know, I wasn't bullied, I wasn't picked on, so I didn't have that part of the experience. In fact, when we were in high school, we were the cool kids. While I was in high school, I also joined the Army Cadets. This is for young kids. And that gave me a new value system and a new peer group. So by the time I was 18, I was being forced to choose a side, which unfortunately, you don't need to choose, and you can, you know, still be in one and in another. But the strict, closed cultural environment in which I grew up, they didn't like the idea of Muslims playing with non-Muslim kids.
Mubin doesn't blame his traditional parents and certainly doesn't suggest he was being radicalized by anyone in the community. But the pressure of a double life got too much, and his partying ways were bringing shame on the family.
They basically forced me to choose, and they said, look, you need to become more religious. At that time, it was still identity and sense of guilt and shame. And so that's what prompted me to go to India and Pakistan. And it was in Pakistan that I would have my meeting with the Taliban.
How did you make that leap to actually going to Pakistan?
The group that I went with is called the Tablighi Jamaat. The Tablighi Jamaat is a missionary group, and they have a headquarters in India and a headquarters in Pakistan. They live in the mosque, you just pray all the time. When I was sent to Pakistan, I was sent to a city called Quetta. In 1995...
A famous place for jihadists,
yeah, of course. Well, in 1995, this was where the Taliban Shura were located. So I was just walking around the local area, you know, in a distance, and I could see some, you know, they had beards, they had turbans, and I thought, oh, these are religious scholars, you know, let me go and talk to them. But as I came close to them, I realized, wait a second, these guys are armed. They have rocket-propelled grenades, machine guns. And I thought to myself, wow, this is cool, right? Young guy, 18 years old, comes from the Army Cadets. You know, I've already been kind of introduced to the ideology, but to the militancy from, you know, a different area. What I then saw in the Taliban was modern-day heroes, You know, the idea of a lost Muslim golden age. Here they are. They were like heroes to me.
Devoted to the cause.
Right.
And prepared to die.
And they looked the part. They looked like they were the very companions of the Prophet, peace be upon him, from, you know, the 700s. I was indoctrinated by them. I mean, I had an encounter with them. They came back to the mosque that we were staying at, and we had some lengthy discussions on, you know, what it meant to be a Muslim, it meant to be a jihadi. And
at this stage, they're still very much in charge of Afghanistan.
Oh, yes. Yeah. They, in 95 is really when they came to power. And what this did, though, was it, you know, I say that I became a member of the global jihadi culture. Because at that time, it was just the Taliban. And then in 1998, then it was bin Laden who gave his fatwa, right? And then it was Al-Qaeda. So what this is, we're dealing with that global jihadi culture.
Mubin didn't join the Taliban, but he returned home to Canada in 1995, inspired by their extremist Islamist doctrine and the emerging jihadists of Al-Qaeda, led by Osama bin Laden, who found a haven in Afghanistan. He saw the Taliban's violent and oppressive control of the country through to 2001 as proof of their extremist ideology's success. You were an outlier doing this in the 1990s. Clearly, we've got a very different picture now today with many, many more young men from Muslim backgrounds in the West, but also of course, from cultures all over the Middle East who have decided that they see something hugely attractive in the jihadist cause. What changed between the 90s and the situation as it exists now in terms of this threat of radicalized youth turning to violent extremism has now become an issue so big that here we are at the UN prioritizing it as one of our main causes?
It's been building really since the 80s, I would say even the 70s. The 80s, of course, you had a lot of military conflicts. Israel-Lebanon War, 1980. First, you have the 79 Islamic Revolution in Iran. You also have the attempted takeover of the Kaaba, of the holiest site in Islam, by extremists in Saudi Arabia. Then 1980, you have Israel-Lebanon War, Iran-Iraq War. Mid-90s, you had the Chechen War, the Second Intifada was starting or had started by 2000. And so I was very involved in those networks at that time, meaning recruiting other young kids, radicalizing, talking, you know, along these lines. For me, 9/11 happened. This made me rethink my commitment. I realized I needed to study the religion properly. I went to Syria in 2002. I spent 2 years there with religious scholars, Sufi religious scholars, of course, who debunked my interpretations, who showed me that you cannot just go to a verse of the Quran or a single hadith or even a group of hadith and just make your own laws. I mean, this was never allowed in the Islamic history, ever.
So this is when you were already harboring doubts about what you've been taught by the Taliban.
So basically what you're dealing with is a deficit in heroism, where terrorism is disguised as heroism. It gives them a sense of masculinity. It gives them a sense of purpose, of belonging, of doing something. And these are things that they don't have in the cultures that they come from. A vacuum exists already, never mind creating vacuums. A vacuum is already there, especially in the Muslim world, where there are problems with governance, problems with freedom in society. And these individuals, they latch onto this stuff. And the ideology, of course. So this is why I gave the quote, ideology without grievances doesn't resonate, and grievances without ideology are not acted upon. Ideology is sometimes a driver with other psychosocial factors, and sometimes ideology is just a passenger where other psychosocial factors are the driver. So it's always a balance and a mix between the two.
So what's going on now in terms of this large increase in the number of young men, mainly of the Muslim faith, mm-hmm. in the whole Middle East and in obviously countries like the UK and Canada, who are becoming jihadists?
The main things go like this. Number one, Syria and the role that Syria plays in apocalyptic literature, especially the Islamic sources when they talk about the coming at the end of times, the great battles that will take place. Syria features as the most important place. This is the reason why the vast majority are choosing Syria and not any other theater of operation. Number two is there has been a psychological priming of the Muslim world for decades. So basically what you have is the abolishment of the caliphate in Turkey, immediately after that, in the 1920s, movements began to reestablish the caliphate. Because in the Muslim mind, there has only been caliphate or the kings, the kingships in the Muslim world.
So Daesh is about a restoration.
Daesh is about a restoration. In the narrative of Islamists, they've talked about, they sell a very utopian worldview of Islam. And they sell it like it is the solution to all the world's problems. This is what they'll say. But they have an imagined history. An imagined history in which Muslims lived happily ever after when they lived under Sharia. And this is completely false. Or even this idea that Muslims lived happily ever after under a caliphate. This is false.
So is it just a question of them perverting Islam, perverting history, and there being a credulous generation of young men who are angry and disaffected who want to buy in? Is that really the kind of key to the
whole
thing?
I think that is. And generation of disaffected who want to buy in to a utopia. And what you will find, they will become disillusioned and disenfranchised because they will realize it will never be achieved. You will never have this perfect Muslim world in which we all live happily ever after. It never existed. So they will find that it doesn't exist. And all they're left in is a loop of violence that only ends in death.
So how did you turn away from this violent path? And what lessons are there in your experience that you think apply to the thousands of young men today who have made the same journey and are perhaps and haven't gone to where you now are yet?
I would really say a modern ideology that, number one, draws from traditional Islam, I believe, is the solution to what we are dealing with now in terms of this modern innovation of extremism and terrorism. And by traditional Islam, we talk about especially Sufism. Sufism has always been a part of Islam. It's only in modern times that people have started
to... So peaceful, tolerant.
Well, yeah, peaceful, tolerant. I mean, we're not pacifists, right? I mean, we believe in peace and justice. But the license to make rules and to declare people as Muslims, not Muslims, this is not your right. This has never been your right in Islam. And this is something that young Muslims need to be reminded of. And because traditional Islam draws on the Quran, on the Sunnah of the Prophet alayhi salam, this is why it is the strongest thing to. Number two, when I say modern ideology, I'm talking about understanding that we live in a modern world. We don't live in the 700s of Arabia. So for example, where, you know, the Quran says certain things, let's say, you know, cut the hand of the thief. So this means that, yes, theft will always be a crime. Okay, so in Islam, we're not changing what God says. But the means by which we enforce the law can change. So you don't need to chop off people's hands. You can give fines, you can imprison them, you can give community service. So there needs to be a revival of the classical Islamic discussions. Because today, if you were to speak like I speak, people would say, oh, this is modernist thinking. But in fact, it's not. In fact, it's traditional thinking. This is how classical Muslim scholars have thought over hundreds of years.
So what kind of work are you now doing to try and reach this generation that's in danger of sliding into the kind of jihadist mindset that you were in not very many years ago?
Yeah. Well, you know, I tried to share my experiences, of course. One of the most important things is drawing legitimacy to this approach. To say, because I come from the perspective of an ex-extremist, you know, of course, I became a counterterrorism operative for some years. And so I understand the security side of it. I sat in a courtroom as a witness giving testimony. So I understand it from the court perspectives. And so this is why the efforts that I've been involved in relate to training parliamentarians, military people and intelligence people, young people, and training them on these two pillars of traditional Islam and a modern interpretation. And these are two things I think need to become pillars of countering violent extremism or preventing violent extremism. These are all things that can be put into practice.
As someone who's working directly with young men and who understands where they are and where they need to go, what role does a global organization like the United Nations have to play in all of this? A lot of speeches are made here, a lot of good intentions are declared. Can the UN be an important and significant force in this debate?
I do think so. I think so because the countries that are most affected, their representatives are here. They can take cues from other member states at the UN, maybe those that have a higher platform or a higher profile, and to learn from them, to understand what is being said at this level, and to know how to then take what is being said at this level and interpret it into a culturally respectful manner, and then deploy it at that level, at the street level, so to speak. So that's one thing. So the example, taking it as an example. And number two, I think a forum itself for young people to come and speak, to hear what people at this level are saying, right? So that you can actually go back and say, hey, I heard people at the United Nations saying Islamophobia is a problem. We heard them saying, you know, don't just pick on Muslims. We heard them saying, have youth involve, you know, more youth involvement. So if they hear this at that level, then it's easier for them to disseminate it at the lower levels.
And what's the language, the approach that the UN, you know, the diplomats and UN officials need to use to try and reach young people? Because obviously, you know, they're much more fluent in modern communication technologies than most of us.
Yeah, I think the United Nations will be well served by bringing people, not just youth who are, you know, in the system already, so to speak, who are saying the right things. You don't want people who are just going to be an echo chamber. You need to bring people really from the hardest areas, people who have never seen, who have never heard. And you need to spend not just one day, but a few days to see exactly what's happening at that level. Because if they understand where they fit, you know, because it's a puzzle and everyone is a piece. And, you know, one piece has its place. You cannot take one piece from the bottom corner and put it on the other side of the puzzle piece. So let them understand what the diplomats are talking about so that they can see where they fit and feel comfortable speaking the way that they speak.
It sounds like from what you were saying earlier that you do believe that this sort of jihadist bubble, this bubble of deception, of perversion of Islam, is going to burst of its own accord. I mean, what can we do as an organization like the United Nations to try and really get this message through to young people that violent extremism is not the answer?
The idea I think a lot of young people have, a mistaken notion, is that they can change the world overnight. When I was 19, that's what I believed. You could change the world overnight, and you could do it through violence, or that you should do it through violence. Well, then what are you going to be left with other than violence? So I think they need to understand that they have a role to play. Their role has to be constructive. If it's going to be destructive, then you're just going to become another statistic. That's it. But if you actually stand your ground, you know, do what you're supposed to do, toil and take and spend 25, 35 years making that change happen, and that's how long it's going to take.
You think it's going to be that long?
It takes that long. I mean, it's a lesson that I've learned. I'm only 40 years old, but I have learned that you cannot change the world overnight. Changing learned behavior, especially in cultural communities, is going to take a very long time. So invest in it appropriately.
If you had to give a young man who was feeling radicalized and feeling aggrieved one bit of advice, one thing that might turn him away from a violent path, what is that?
Always go back to the Quran and the Sunnah, and the example of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The Prophet alayhi salam was not a terrorist. He was not an extremist. Even before he claimed prophethood, he was known as the trustworthy, Al-Amin. So ask yourself, I would say to this young person, what example of the Prophet alayhi salam are you showing to the people? The real martyr is that father, that mother, who gets up every day in the face of racism, in the face of discrimination, in the face of all sorts of obstacles, internal and external, to put food on the table for their children. Those are the real martyrs. Not you, some 15, 16, 17-year-old punk who's given up his life for the wrong reasons completely. You know what's more difficult to do? Live.
Thanks very much indeed.
Most welcome.
Mubin Sheikh talking to me, Matthew Wells, here at UN headquarters. The former counter-terrorism operative for Canadian intelligence and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police is currently a PhD candidate in psychology at Liverpool University in the UK. That's it from this edition of The Lid Is On from UN Radio. Thank you for listening.